I'm taking our text this morning from the first chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew. We'll not read this whole section, this chapter. Just a reminder, there is first that genealogy, that story where Jesus, his human parentage comes from. There is the appearance of the angel and to Joseph, and the preparation. And we come to the announcement in verse 21, Matthew chapter 1 and verse 21. The angel said, "And she will bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." So all this was done, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "Behold, the virgin shall be with child, and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which is translated, "God with us." So you will see we read also in the prophet Isaiah where that promise is made. And Matthew says this promise is here fulfilled in Jesus. So we, seeking God's help, let us turn here together this morning. I think Christmas is really about the child Christ. Sometimes you might not think so, but that is where the name comes from. This child who was called Jesus because he would save his people from their sins. But it's funny as well, even as we read this, how we're not allowed very much these days to put Jesus and sins together in the same sentence. The Bible does. That's why he has that name. We learn about his purpose in coming, why he was born, because he will save his people from their sins. That tells us why he became Jesus. But Matthew goes on to offer an explanation further concerning that. And his explanation is that all this was done so that the word of the prophet, or the word of the Lord through the prophet, will be fulfilled. That word being from Isaiah chapter 7 verse 14, "Behold, the virgin in Isaiah shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel." And Matthew adds that is translated from the Hebrew, "God with us." How significant is this Old Testament reference that Matthew makes? Is it just a convenient coincidence that Matthew spots in the events that unfolded? Or is there something here that we need to dwell on to gain a richer perception concerning the coming of Jesus among us? We should immediately, when we see words such as this, we should immediately reflect on what the prophet did say, and the context of that prophecy. And when we do that, I think we will find much more that will enrich our understanding, help us to appreciate even more what Jesus has done. William Still makes a remarkable comment. He says this: "What could reveal the wrath of God against sin as fearfully as the birth, ministry, and finally the death of his son?" You ask somebody casually, what does somebody who has some sense of these things, what does the birth of Jesus signify? More often than not, you'll have a message concerning the love of God, and I don't deny that. But this is a remarkable comment, that the birth as well as the ministry and the death of Jesus reveals the wrath of God against sin. Even the birth of Jesus is a revelation of God's wrath against my sin. Even his birth should stir up godly fear in us. Even the birth of Jesus demonstrates the seriousness of my sin. Even his birth demonstrates and shows God's abhorrence of my sin. Why else did he come? Except that God would be rid of sin. It was an enormous event, this entry of the Son of God into the life of man, to die for men, all for the sins of men. Why is he called Jesus? Why is this name Jesus so well known around the world? For one reason only: to save people from their sins, his people, to make them his people. And that too surely demonstrates how utterly impossible it is for you or for me to live with God except by putting your trust in this Jesus and what he's done. Only then can you live with God. Emmanuel, God with us. And this is the message that we find in the context of the prophecy. And I propose to examine the Isaiah passage and to seek to establish the intention of that prophecy. It was a prophecy even then, a foretelling of something to come. And then to carry that across and to grasp Matthew's message when he says, all this was done so that this prophecy would be fulfilled. What is that prophecy? And I would put it this way, that the prophecy is at the heart, it's the key, it's raising the question, and where that the child that is born or is foretold, he is asking Ahaz, he's asking Judah in the Old Testament, which way are you going to turn? And he asks the same question today, in the New Testament age. So asking back in the prophet, in Old Testament Judah, where will you turn? That's the question to the king, Ahaz. In a nutshell, at that point, Judah was in trouble. The kingdom of Judah, they had been split from their northern brethren, known as Israel, for around about 200 years. And now, at this particular point, their northern brothers, who were also descendants of Israel, had come to attack Jerusalem. They went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, in verse 1 of chapter 7. They, being Israel in the north, and in alliance with a slightly further north kingdom, Syria, or Aram, the Arameans. And the first 9 verses of Isaiah 7 are referring to these people coming against Judah and against Jerusalem. And as a result, Ahaz, the king, was looking for answers. How is he going to survive? How is he going to set these people back? And his plan, when you examine the fuller context, was to go to a kingdom even further north than Syria and say to them, please come and help. And this was Assyria. And they were a growing power at the time, already very powerful. It's a bit like if there was some small country under threat today. You might then get in touch with the White House in Washington in the U.S., and ask them to commit to a military alliance and to intervene. But very often in return, they would say, now you can have exploration rights for natural resources in our country. Well, that's what was happening with Judah and Assyria. Ahaz had to pay a terrible price to Assyria for the alliance that he was looking for. And it's into that situation that God comes in Isaiah chapter 7 through Isaiah the prophet. And I think we can say that God had two things to say to Ahaz. He's saying to them, first of all, in verse 7 and following especially, he's already said it in prose in the previous verses. In verse 4, for example, take heed and be quiet, do not fear or be faint-hearted. And he describes them as stubs of smoking firebrands. They're burnt low and they're just about to go out. And then he talks about it in more poetic terms from verse 7. You know these nations to the north of you, he's saying to Ahaz. You're desperately concerned about them. You're very anxious, and that's perhaps why he was out there walking where Isaiah met him. God says, I know them as well. And I'm telling you how things are going to be with them. It's not going to last. And it won't be very long before they're gone, before they're done. Look at them, he says in poetic form, verses 7 through to 9. You take that nation, it looks formidable, but think down to its head, it's a city. What is that city? It's run by a man, a son of a man. That's a very, very striking way. He says the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. Son of a man. That's all he is. And he's the one who's pushing these things. But what is he? Do notice as we read here that this is not just a prophecy about what's to come as we often think of prophecy. It's a statement of things as they are. That's what you're facing. It is, first of all, proclamation of God's word. That's what prophecy is. So that's one thing that he had to say. You know those two nations, Syria, Israel, Ephraim, in other words, they're not going to last. Now, the other thing is, you're looking to another nation. Now, let's think about them for a moment. You're thinking to commit to them. Don't. Don't do it. They are powerful. They are the enemies that will destroy Israel and Samaria and Syria. But I'm telling you, God says, they will not stop there. They'll keep on coming. And you'll be right in their path. And you will suffer as they do. For short-term relief, you'll then bring worse trouble on yourselves. It strikes me it's really rather like one of those, they can be quite comic at times, but one of those good news, bad news scenes. That it's like God says, I can assure you, your enemies will be destroyed. And Ahaz, almost you can see the lift of his shoulders, oh, that's good news. God says, well, not entirely, because the bad news is that the other people are coming at you as well. That is bad news. But of course, this being God that Ahaz is dealing with, there is a further good news element. That's where this promise comes in. It all depended on which way Ahaz would turn. Would he hear what God had to say on that day? And would he turn away from Assyria, or would he turn to them? Would he turn away from God, or would he turn to God? Which way will you turn? That's the point that Ahaz is at here. Would he listen to God? Would he carry on in the route that he seems to have been planning all along? And this passage is all about God calling him to pull him back. God coming to say, I will be with you. Even when things are looking especially grim, I will be with you. You must have faith. Hold on to that faith. And I will be strong and establish you. Again, there are two things he's saying. He says, I will be with you through these tough times. But he also says, I will not be with you if you will not take my word, if you will not trust me, if you'll go and look somewhere else for your help. And it, as it tells us from verse 17 onwards, the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house. It would be a dreadful time. You've not known something like this for 200 years. If they carried on as they were, they would find that they would not last very much longer as a nation either. It's in the middle of this that he gives the sign. The boy who will be called Emmanuel. That means God with us. Someone, somewhere, was going to proclaim their faith, naming their child. The description of time here indicates that this would only be a few years' time. From verse 15 it tells us, curds and honey he shall eat. And then in verse 16, before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, which is connected with what he eats, in verse 15, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. It's saying that he will start to eat solids. Weaning a child in those days took between 2 and 4 years. He would start to eat solids, something other than his mother's milk. Curds being yogurt. And that would tell us that it was then that he would, as God puts it, he will know to refuse the evil and to choose the good. Children do learn what's the difference between good and evil very quickly. And that's what's reflected here. And so in just a very short time. Elsewhere it does refer to 65 years, but there's a great intensity to this particular passage. And so in a very short time, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. On balance, this appears to point to a young woman soon to give birth to a son. This particular young woman, it's one in a particular view. Behold the virgin, a particular person. She will conceive and bear a son. So we reckon that it would be someone known to the king. She's not named, but known to the king. Now, when we read that, and we've read Matthew chapter 1, we will often immediately take it and say it's Jesus and Mary the Virgin. But there is a very current context in Isaiah's day and Ahaz's day, something that Ahaz himself would see and recognize and have God's word confirmed to him. So some students wonder if it might even be a reference to the king's own wife. Because the child's age was to be the marker for the demise, the disappearance of these two kings and kingdoms. We have to look for a fulfillment within that first generation. Ahaz has been directed by God himself to ask for a sign. Ahaz says, "I will not." He refuses. He does it very proudly. He does it with a very clever theological statement and argument. In verse 12, he bases it on God's own word. When God was speaking to Israel, they were testing him and they were forbidden to do so in the wilderness journeys. And so Ahaz takes that up, but he misapplies it. He had already been told by God, "You must ask for a sign." And this reflects that he was unwilling to hear anything else from God. He was unwilling to receive any indication from God. There was a heart that was hard against the things that God might offer to him. He was unwilling to believe. Faith was the issue. Every circumstance around Ahaz was frightening to the people. It would be no more frightening to the other people, the nations had come up against Jerusalem to make war against it, that the average person would see this. All the more if this young mother was part of the royal household, she would know the fear of Ahaz, his anxieties. But still, this particular mother was going to use the name Emmanuel, God with us, God is with us. That was her testimony of faith in the middle of everything. A sign would appear. God gave it anyway. This is what will happen. Some folk these days say that they would hesitate to bring children into this world. They do say that. You've heard it yourselves, I'm sure. But this woman, in far worse circumstances, she said, I will bring forth a child and I will tell the world God is with us. I do believe. In verse 8, at the end of that poem, if you will not believe, and you can understand the words behind that, convey the idea that if you will not be firm, it's a play on words here. If you will not be firm, surely you will not be firm. You will not be established. If you, your own faith will not hold fast to God, God will not establish you. This woman says, whatever is going on around me, I still believe, I trust in God. God is with us. When God says he will be with us, as he has done through his covenant promises from the beginning of the nation, I believe him. She calls his name Emmanuel. And all the more so if this was part of the royal household. There was Ahaz, who went after Assyria. He put his trust in another nation. There was this little child growing up, Emmanuel. His mother would call out to him, Emmanuel, calling out, God with us, God with us. What a thorn in the ear that would be for this king who had turned away from God, who had not exercised faith in the God who had come to offer safety to him. Well, that's something very quickly about the context and the background and the significance of that initial prophecy through Isaiah. Testimony of faith and a call to the king and God's people to put their faith in God. I believe that is the message that Matthew has in mind, that this very prophecy and its significance is to be fulfilled above all in this Jesus who will save his people from their sins. One of the older Christmas songs is, O come, Emmanuel. It is 12th century words, 15th century music, a long-standing one. And you'll hear it quite often. I heard it just the other day on the radio. And in the service, carol services and things, you'll often find it's being used. People are singing. And there's people who go to carol services who otherwise seem to have very little time for God. And they sing these words, O come, Emmanuel, God with us. Matthew is reminding us of the meaning, what this coming of Emmanuel does mean. That it is a confession of faith. That God is with men. And he says here, this is the great fulfillment of such words. God is with men in this Jesus. The Jesus that people speak of, especially today, his birth, was that coming of God to be with man in a way that has never been matched before or since. Back there in the days of Ahaz, there were God's chosen people, the people of Judah, and they needed rescue. They needed relief from enemies. God promised that he would do it. He said, don't worry about those people. I know, I'm telling you, they'll be gone. Now the question is, what about you? There was another deliverance that was needed. And this is where Ahaz did unrighteously put God to the test. Judah desperately needed to turn their hearts back to God. What kind of deliverance was needed? Yes, from Israel in the north and Syria, also from the threat of Assyria. Where would they find their help? First, they needed to be delivered from the pride of their hearts. They needed to be those amongst whom God could live once again. They needed to be saved from their sins. We read as we started worship last week, rend your hearts, not just your garments. Deal with the deep-seated need. Which way will you turn? And see this great fulfillment. It's taking you and saying, your problems are not just Israel and Syria. Your problems are not just Assyria, however big Assyria might seem to be, and however brutal they were. Your problem is your heart. What is Jesus coming for? First of all, to save his people from their sins so that God can be with us. The worst of the sins of Israel was that they had lost their faith in God. The young woman said, I believe God is with us. Emmanuel means God with us. God has come among us. God is with men. And it's not just about escaping from one thing that we're afraid of only to fall into the arms of a greater danger. God is with us when we are with him. How are we with him? It's to be free from the bondage of sin. In Isaiah's day, Emmanuel was a tremendous declaration of faith. It is again, as we connect it with Jesus, it is in Jesus that we are to put our trust. We live in a world where folk are increasingly saying, you can get to God in all sorts of different ways. And then they turn back to the Christian preacher or believer and they say, but you say it's just one. How can it just be one? How can it just be this little child who was born so many years ago and was born long after so many generations and was born in one little place? If there is just one way to God, why doesn't he tell the world? Jesus is just about the most famous name anyone can find. He is telling the world. But you see what needs to happen here. He needed to come to save his people from their sins. Only a man can save man from man's sins. God had to become man to bring about this deliverance. God to be with us in the fullest possible sense had to be man. And you and I know very well that man can only be in one place at one time. That's the way it had to be. But from there, there's been an explosion. There is this great word that is going out. Paul put it in Galatians 4. When the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his Son. It doesn't stop there. That day will come when no one will need to be told that he is there, he is here. Everyone will know. But in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman. That one child, Jesus. Born under the law to redeem those who were under the law, to be one with us. The son of a young woman, a virgin, the Greek Old Testament puts it, who was called Emmanuel. And this Jesus, not just a sign of God's interest, God's presence, God's overruling towards his people. This Jesus was Emmanuel, is Emmanuel. He is fully God with man. That word is fully filled. Your time is gone. Ahaz was offered a sign, he refused. When that sign was given to him, I think when you just read that story, you know that sign would be a dreadful inconvenience to him. That lad would be a constant reminder to him of the faith in God which he did not have and chose not to exercise. When men approach what Jesus really is, he is another, indeed the greatest, inconvenient truth. They therefore throw his name around carelessly. They'll fudge his story. They'll refuse his call, his offer, raising all kinds of objections. How can he be the one? Anything but an answer of faith in God through him. Look at yourselves today. Look at the world around us today. What is your Assyria? What is the world's Assyria? There's one problem, so you turn to try and find help in some other way. The government turns to others for help. We've seen it just in recent weeks. The others will turn on them. A business or an individual goes to the bank for financial support, and the bank just starts to charge them more. You think the boss is a friend, or somebody very popular at school is your friend, and the point comes where they'll turn away from you, snub you, and reject you. There are so many ways in which we would sooner turn from a lesser evil to a greater evil and think that that's our help. That's the Assyrian. And in the middle of that, God cuts in and he says, but what about me? What about Jesus? What about Christmas? 700 years after that prophecy was first made, the fullness of time came. Emmanuel was accomplished fully. Jesus was born. And the same question remains today as it was those 2,700 years ago, 2,000 years ago with Jesus. Jesus himself said it in Luke chapter 18. He said, when the Son of Man returns, will he find faith on the earth? Because that's the question. We talk about Christmas. That must take you to think on Christ, who is this Jesus. He asks you a question. Every moment you hear his name, and you hear the name Emmanuel that belongs to him, he asks you the question, will you believe? Will you testify? God is with us. Will men put their trust in him? Will you put your trust in him? In everything. Recognize that only he can help. And by trusting in him, you'll find that deepest, deepest need dealt with. He will save you from your sins. This morning, just so far, and seeking God's blessing, may he apply his words to each of our hearts. Let us pray together.